Support comes from Gemma, architects, planners, and designers seeking to bring joy to their clients and communities. Details at gemastl.com.
This is St. Louis on the Air from St. Louis Public Radio. I'm Elaine Cha. Every year, thousands of people move through Missouri's parole system, leaving prison to complete their sentences under state supervision. And many end up returning there. In fact, about 50% of all the people detained in Missouri prisons are there because of violations of conditions of release. The state's parole system is now under the spotlight. Under an executive order by Missouri Governor Mike Kehoe, a group of experts has been assembled to come up with recommendations to improve the system, one that governs the lives of more than 50,000 people. The group's first meeting took place earlier this summer in June. Earlier this month, I sat down with three members of the working group, including public defender Stacey Lannert. Her clients are people charged with violating their parole.
When we talk about parole and supervision, people rarely think about it unless it affects their families, right? But it actually affects every resident of the state, because the state is putting money into incarceration and into supervision, and 9 times out of 10, that person is going to be returned to the community. And what type of person would we like to see returned to that community? Recidivism usually doesn't happen until the 3rd or 5th year of supervision. It doesn't happen immediately. Mm-hmm. So that's showing that something isn't quite right. And how can we change this from a punishment-based system to recognizing the trauma involved and helping heal?
That was Missouri Public Defender Stacey Lannert speaking on this show last month. It's not clear when the working group will hand its recommendations to the governor, but critics of the state's parole system say there is a lot of work to be done. And to talk about what those improvements might be, I'm joined by Amy Malinowski. She's the co-director of the MacArthur Justice Center's Missouri office. Amy, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
We also have Norman Brown. Norman spent 31 years in prison after receiving a life sentence for his role in an armed robbery committed when he was 15 years old. He was released on parole a little over 3 years ago. Norman, welcome to you as well.
Thank you for having me.
So, Amy, the MacArthur Justice Center has sued Missouri's parole system multiple times. Why that focus?
Well, thank you for that question. Parole is an issue that impacts almost 50,000 people in the state of Missouri. So it actually has a huge reach across the state. And it's a huge driver of mass incarceration in the state and nationally as well. And when we started to take a look at it in Missouri, we noticed that it was an incredibly opaque and unfair system that was out of step with decades-long requirements that were announced by the Supreme Court or even by state law, and really needed reform in a significant number of ways.
In filing all of those lawsuits against Missouri's parole system, Amy, what is it that you have learned about it by challenging it?
I guess the short answer is a lot. You know, parole is supposed to be an opportunity for people to get out of prison when they can be released without being a risk of harm to themselves or others. It's supposed to provide hope. But it's failing in the state of Missouri because the parole board makes subjective and arbitrary decisions and denies parole to a huge number of people at their first hearing. And it's failing at the back end too on supervision because people are being revoked and sent back to prison for technicalities, which does not serve the individual, does not serve the community, and doesn't make us safer.
Mm-hmm. How many of those lawsuits have resulted in wins for your clients?
Well, I guess it depends on what you consider a win. I would say Norman Brown sitting next to
yes,
me here
I am.
Today is a pretty huge win, even though the Eighth Circuit overturned our success in the courts. But a number of them, including a class action about parole revocation that resulted in the creation of the revocation defense team that Stacey Lannert leads at the public defender system. There have also been wins outside of the courtroom in educating the parole board and changing a bit of the culture of the parole board as well.
Mm-hmm. Norman, you were just 17 when you were convicted of first-degree murder.
Yes.
You were with an older man who robbed a store and fatally shot its owner. You were not the shooter, but you were sentenced to life without parole. And you did eventually face a parole board. So you've experienced some of what Amy has described. Norman, walk us through what that experience of coming before the board was like for you.
Well, today makes like almost the third anniversary of me being released from prison. I was released July 28th of 2022. And I actually had two parole hearings. My first hearing was a disaster. In so many ways, a disaster that exposed the archaic nature of the parole board. I actually was represented by an attorney who were partnering, was actually director or co-director of the MacArthur Justice Center. And through my first hearing, and we were faced with, at that time, we were faced with a parole board that didn't followed the dictates of Miller, in the sense that children should be, I guess, dealt with differently or looked at differently for the purpose of punishment, because we shouldn't have been held to the standard of an adult, because our minds hadn't developed to the level of an adult. And during that first hearing, I have to tell you this before we get to the hearing, because so many things led up to the hearing. You have what you call a pre-hearing, and a pre-hearing is held by an institutional parole officer, which is an IPO. An IPO stands for institutional parole officer, and the institutional parole officer is usually a correctional officer who has been promoted. So this person has some sort of interaction with inmates, and, you know, be it good or bad, you know, they bring their, it's possible that they could bring their biasness, I guess, to the table when dealing with inmates now, that they have this particular power. And just so happened, my IPO was a guy named Jared. And Jared was known for being one of the COs who took an aggressive approach to inmates. And it just so happened that he was the IPO now. And so I had to deal with him. And looking back, with hindsight being 2020, looking back, he brought those biases to the parole sphere. And so in my case, during the IPO hearing, the pre-hearing, I told Mr. Jarrett that I was bringing my attorney as my representative, because at the you can have one representative or one delegate or one person to support you through your parole hearing. And that was frowned upon. Like, he almost threatened me in so many ways not to bring my attorney.
Mm-hmm.
And once he noticed that I would stand fast on bringing my attorney, you know, he told me that she would not be looked upon as an attorney. And like, her years of going to school, her years of hard work, her years of legal professionalism was just wiped away just because the parole board had the power to do that.
Mm-hmm. And this was the pre-hearing.
This was the pre-hearing before we even got to the hearing.
So, Amy, how common is what Norman has just described?
Well, it's still pretty common. So back in 2016, 2017, when we started getting involved in parole hearings, we would show up and they'd look at us like we had three heads, because lawyers were just not in those rooms, right? Historically, the parole board has enjoyed an incredible amount of privacy. Hearings are closed. Records are closed. We don't know how they make decisions or why they make decisions that they make. And so to have anyone in those hearings that might, you know, be holding them to account really rubbed them the wrong way.
Mm-hmm.
And
I mean, and Norman is one of your clients. So when he was sentenced as a teenager, he didn't have the right to parole. And it took years of lawsuits to force the parole system to acknowledge that, as you said, Norman, you mean people who are sentenced to prison as juveniles, they do need to be treated differently. The prefrontal cortex is not completely developed yet. I mean, to what extent has the parole system actually addressed that issue?
Well, one of the positive outcomes of the lawsuit in which Norman was a lead plaintiff was requiring training on adolescent development for parole board members and parole staff, because to the extent that they considered youth at all before that, it was actually as an aggravator rather than a mitigating factor. So this training is provided and actually gives them a decent understanding of why youth matters and why it matters in ways that mitigate culpability for crimes.
Mm-hmm. And Norman, you are serving your sentence right now on parole. What does that mean for your life, like in the day to day?
Well, before I answer that question, is it okay if I say that one of the protections of acknowledging youth, I think, has been rolled back by the parole board. I think these some of the protections that were set in place by the court because of the lawsuits have been rolled back, and I think that's a travesty. It means the parole board has reverted back to this barbaric, archaic way of dealing with inmates of my class, or just inmates in general. And I think that's and I just wanted to make that to her point.
Yeah.
At least let you know that these things have been rolled back. So I do believe that reform is mandatory. It's a must. Now, to your question, I'm grateful, because my friend and her colleagues have really, really fought really hard for us, for myself to be home and to be free. And my day-to-day is I go to work. I enjoy my work. I enjoy what I do. I actually own a business. Mm-hmm. I'm starting another business. And I check in with my parole officer. I'm very conscious of the things I do. I don't drink alcohol. I don't do drugs. I don't jaywalk. I don't blow stop signs. You know, I'm very conscious of my day-to-day life because I am on parole. And as Amy spoke, I know people can be violated for just the littlest things. And so I'm, like, extra careful. I'm always not on edge, but on my toes when it comes to the things I do, the places I am, and the people I be around.
Amy, we're talking about what Norman is experiencing, what he has experienced in the context of this working group that has come together under the executive order of Missouri Governor Mike Kehoe. You were at the first parole working group meeting in June. What did you think of it?
Well, that's a great question. I think we're limited in our time. I agree, first of all, with the chairman's statement that this is a once-in-a-decade opportunity. What a tremendous opportunity to take a hard look at these regulations that, you know, impact the freedom and lives of countless Missourians. And I was cautiously optimistic, which is why I wanted to be there, which is why I've been sort of hounding the group to let me join in on the fun a little bit. And I have to say, I was really grateful for the folks who spoke, especially Clifton Davis, who I thought made some great points. I was grateful for the opportunity to speak. And I've been disappointed ever since with sort of the failure to, walk the walk, so to speak. Mm-hmm.
This is St. Louis Public Radio. Support comes from Parrot Corporation. With a commitment to serving the St. Louis community through local partnerships and charitable support, guided by Parrot's core values. More at parrot.com/culture.
Welcome back. We're continuing our look today at Missouri's parole system, which affects the lives of more than 50,000 people in the state. And it is a system that's under review. An official working group created by an executive order by Missouri Governor Mike Kehoe has been tasked with coming up with recommendations to improve it. At the working group's inaugural meeting in June, the chairman of the Missouri Parole Board, Tony Helfrich, opened with remarks that included a note about the group's ultimate goal, quote, promoting successful reintegration and reducing recidivism. That raises a very pressing challenge for this group. Sometimes it's not even clear what parole rule a person has violated to be sent back to prison or what they can do to address it. That's what happened to Terrell Robinson. He served 20 years in prison before his release on parole. He admitted to his parole officer that he used marijuana and alcohol and planned to seek treatment. He was never charged with a crime. But in 2009, he was sent back to prison, and he's still there 16 years later.
Yeah, I mean, the parole board is, it's a draconian system, and it's cruel and it's severe. And I'm saying, you know, we put ourselves in these positions, you know, they look at parole as a right, not a privilege. And so, you know, we're at their mercy, you know, whether we believe it or not. And they, you know, you can only bring one delegate in. They can bring as many witnesses in as they want. So, you know, the table is kind of stacked in their behalf. But if I can take back everything in my life, man, you know, it most definitely would be not to come back in the grips of these particular people that I'm dealing with now.
That was Terrell Robinson, currently incarcerated in Missouri's Northeast Correctional Center. Unless something changes, he's due to be released in 2037. He spoke yesterday to producer Danny Wisentowski. Robinson's situation is extreme, but not rare. To continue our conversation about Missouri's parole system, I'm here with Amy Malinowski. She's the co-director of the MacArthur Justice Center's Missouri office. And also with us is Norman Brown. He was released on parole a little over 3 years ago after spending 31 years in prison. Norman, yes. You're on parole. Listening to Terrell Robinson, what stands out to you?
Well, what stands out the most is I personally know Terrell, and I know Terrell is honestly a really good person. Like, he's a really good guy. And he said something about delegates, and that is really, really important. From my personal experiences, if I didn't have the delegates that I had, the advocacy that I had, I would have had no way whatsoever to show the parole board the man I had become during those 30 years, or the person or the child I was before I had gotten there. I would not have been able to marshal the resources for a successful reentry into society. It was the delegates that were able to do the footwork, because I was in prison. I was locked behind a gate, so I couldn't seek out these resources because of funding. And so many inmates can't seek out these resources because of funding. But there are resources out here that will allow people like Terrell and so many others, myself, to come home to resources that will help them reintegrate successfully into society. And delegates, if there are people in this state willing to be delegates for him, why not? It can only be a help to prison, the parole system, and ultimately every citizen in the state of Missouri. Mm-hmm. And so that's really important, being able to have a family member and a delegate a part of your parole hearing. Mm-hmm. And the fact that they have stripped that is just barbaric and just archaic. Mm-hmm. You know, it's not progressive.
So, Amy, to clarify then, do people facing parole, you know, get to have a delegate or representative to be there, you know, for them in this process? In that IPO part of it, you had mentioned before the break, there was some resistance to the idea, yes, of your having anyone, but how does this all shake out?
So the state regulations do give an individual who's incarcerated the right to have one person there as their quote-unquote delegate. And, you know, there are some rules about who that can be, but generally speaking, it's up to that individual who they have. That puts people in a position of having to choose between, you know, their attorney if they have one and their mother, or if they have multiple family members who want to be there to support the individual and to, you know, share with the board why they feel the person should be let out. They're really given a Sophie's choice in that situation. And the times in the past that I have been the delegate for clients, I've been told this is not a lawyering moment. We're not retrying the case, but I can tell you, at least in the past, and in Norman's case.
And to your point, yeah, and I wanted to make a statement. May was told to shut up in my hearing. I had the delegate, which was her co-director at the time, attorney May Quinn. She was told to be quiet, shut up in the hearing, that the first hearing I was telling you about. And so attorneys and delegates could really, really, really face fire when dealing with these parole boards.
Yeah. And there are no such limitations on the side of the victim, who, of course, has the right to participate. But we've, you know, prosecuting attorneys were at juvenile parole hearings, presenting trial exhibits.
I agree. I actually went through that. You know, I had a prosecutor that brought in a whole bunch of exhibits, and my victim had made a statement that I did have a gun at the scene of the crime, and I did not. You know, so like Amy said, you know, things are able to be presented, you know, falsehoods are able to be presented. And it's important, in my opinion, it's important to have an attorney there who could kind of keep the process fair and to just what it is to a parole hearing. And to the point of who you get to bring, like, our families don't know the law or what should be sought after to assist us in our rehabilitation or to assist us in our reintegration. Mm-hmm. And so it's important to have family and maybe an attorney or, you know, a delegate of that sort of caliber.
That kind of background. Yeah. Amy, so in hearing from Terrell Robinson, he was sent back to prison for violating parole. And so from one perspective, he did violate, but he served almost 16 years in prison. I mean, what can someone like him do to show that he can and maybe should be released?
Well, that sure would be wonderful to know. But the way that the board makes decisions right now, and that's one of the problems with it, is that they do not convey to the individual why parole was denied and what that person can do to prepare themselves to be released. So they use boilerplate decision notices that say, you know, the circumstances of the crime is why you're being held back, or institutional adjustment, whatever that means. They don't actually provide any guidance to the individual to prepare them for release. And that is, by statute, sort of the test that they are supposed to be considering. Now, I know in Mr. Robinson's case, there's very active opposition from the wife of the victim in the underlying crime, which also took place when he was a juvenile. And she's been very successful in recruiting other Back the Blue folks to, you know, send letters to the board in opposition. Now, we don't have access to that material because everything the board considers in these hearings is a closed record, even to the person going up for parole. Norman talked about the deck being stacked against you. It's stacked against you and you can't see what's in it either.
Exactly. Mm-hmm.
Some moments ago, I had mentioned the remarks that the parole board chairman gave in the opening of the first working group meeting that was public, and he mentioned recidivism. And in 2024, about one-third of all new admissions to prisons in Missouri came from people whose parole was revoked. So that comes to almost 4,000 individuals. What does that tell you, Amy, about the parole process?
Well, a caveat to that, their parole was revoked through a knowingly unconstitutional system, right? So in one of our lawsuits, the state of Missouri admitted that it was violating due process rights of the 6,000 to 7,000 people who went through revocation every single year. Obviously the system is broken. Half of those folks who are being sent back on revocations, they're for technicalities, not for committing a new crime. And parole should not be revoked on a mere technicality. People should be supported to stay in their communities. That is what serves public safety, not over-incarceration.
In our last few minutes, Amy, you're not a member of that working group, but you were at its first meeting. Given what you saw there, what is it that you want to see coming from this working group moving forward?
The most important thing I would like to see, and I really hope they're listening right now, is, you know, like I said, to walk the walk. They were specifically directed to make recommendations to improve transparency and accountability in the parole system. But they are flaunting Missouri's law on governmental transparency, the Sunshine Law. They're not providing notices of meetings. They're not preparing agendas. They're not keeping minutes of meetings. And so we, as the public, actually have no idea what they are working on, mm-hmm. What they're considering, and what their recommendations might be.
And Norman, very briefly, what do you hope that the working group looks at?
I have absolutely nothing to add to what she said. It was so perfect, like perfectly said.
Well, this is clearly something that warrants much more conversation. I appreciate the time that you've spent today and hope to catch up with you in the future. Norman Brown spent 31 years in prison after receiving a life sentence for his role in an armed robbery committed when he was 15 years old. He was released on parole a little over 3 years ago. And Amy Malinowski is the co-director of the MacArthur Justice Center's Missouri office. Each of you, again, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks.
This episode was produced by Danny Wisentowski.
Audio engineering and podcast design by Aaron Dorr.
Our executive producer is Alex Hoyer.
St. Louis on the Air is a production of St. Louis Public Radio. Understanding starts here.
Do you find yourself regularly listening to episodes of St. Louis on the Air? Suggest us to a friend you think might enjoy our conversations. And leave us a review and rating on Apple Podcasts on the App Store. It's the simplest way to help people discover our show. Thank you.
St. Louis Public Radio is a member-supported service of the University of Missouri, St. Louis.
The Gateway brings you the day's news each weekday from around the St. Louis region and the state capitals in Jefferson City.
Our schools are accredited. We don't need this bill.
And Springfield.
How many more years must pass before lawmakers see time is of the essence?
I'm Abby Larico. Join me each weekday for The Gateway on the STLPR app or wherever you get podcasts.